Yeah, it's going to be fun. So welcome, folks, to another episode of the podcast, now closing in on a name, where we do actually have a poll going, and I think this is going to be the last week of that poll, because we're getting ready to close it at the end of the month here, where you get your say in what we're going to call this thing. And so we've got a couple of we canned because they weren't that funny. We've got a couple of them that seemed period appropriate and are like a little clever but not outright funny. So we have the Pod of the Light Brigade. We have Mentioned in Dispatches, which seems to be a favorite among some of the podcast participants. We also have, you know, Pants Are Optional or something like that. No pants necessary.
Podcast was my vote.
Yeah, well, there's a reason that that's not on there. You're welcome to vote for something else. So, part of it is, of course, that we're trying not to be too overly derivative of other places in which we've participated and sort of start something new and do something a little different here. But that said, we're still having a podcast and we're still having a good time, and we've still got Chris showing up on a regular basis for that podcast. So, Chris, how you doing?
Wait, who's Chris? Oh, sorry. That's
yeah, you.
I'm good, yeah.
When I've only got one Chris on here, I don't have to go with screen names. I can go with, like, your real name. I realize you're used to answering to, hey, you, but, you know, I thought we'd go with who you actually are.
Yeah, totally caught me off guard, yeah.
Yeah, and back for a second stint in the same season is Gary. That's a little weird. Hi, Gary.
Hey, how's it going?
So, you know, we're not going back to the tried and true same old formula of questions that we had before, but I did want to throw one random something out there, because I think I know where Chris is going to come from with this. But what was the last game that you actually learned at a convention? Gary, what was the last one you learned at a convention?
Would have been Close Action at Winterfest in February.
Okay, how'd it go?
I thought it went really well. So there's a funny story behind this, actually. So it's an Age of Sail game, right? Think Wooden Ships and Iron Man. It's more detailed. So it's kind of up my alley. So we're playing it, and I'm like, hey, this is pretty cool. I wonder if this is still in print. I pull on my phone right on the spot, pull up Clash of Arms' website. It's in print. They have it in print. I get home that night. It's out of print.
Oh, man.
I'm like, what? What, did somebody just buy the last copy out of their warehouse? Evidently.
Yeah, that's maybe somebody else in the game with you.
It could have been. Yeah. That's possible.
You said something there that sort of scared me a little bit. You said it's like Wooden Ships and Iron Men, but more complicated?
Yes.
Ouch.
Wooden Ships and Iron Men is an introductory war game.
Okay. It's an introductory exercise in chart and record keeping.
Yes. Oh God, you should have played another game. I learned at that Winterfest was actually Flat Top. You want your double blind bookkeeping action? That's where you go. That thing is a double blind bookkeeping plot in your movement masterpiece.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was fantastic, though.
It was really fun. We actually ran it double blind with a referee, and we just got like reports every turn of, you know, what the scouts were seeing, and we ran the Japanese carrier task force into an American battleship task force, and the planes were all out at the time doing other stuff, looking for the American carrier task force, I believe, and we got caught totally pants down.
So it wasn't just, hey, there's a lot of blue water, next turn. Hey, there's a lot of blue water, next turn. Hey, there's a lot of blue water.
Well, the advantage of playing it with a referee is the referee can say, here, you know, give me standing orders, and then he can, you know, buzz through 15 turns where nothing happens.
Yeah.
And then tell us, okay, at 8:45 a.m., you get this report.
Yeah, I suppose that would be helpful. So, yeah, Wooden Ships and Iron Men always looked really cool, but fifth grade me didn't find it all that entertaining. I imagine, you know, older me would probably dig it a little more, but fifth grade me found it to be an exercise in record keeping that just wasn't a lot of fun.
In all seriousness, it is not a particularly light game.
No, not really at all. So, All right, Chris, you were laughing. So last one you learned at a convention.
Well, I was at a convention last weekend in Connecticut for Compass Games. It was their first annual Compass Expo, and I signed up for a tournament of their game, Bitter Woods, which is an old, old, old game, 20 years old, going back to first published by Avalon Hill or L2, whatever. There's been multiple versions of it. So Compass has it now. It's a game I've played a few times, and I showed up for this tournament and was immediately paired up with someone who's been playing it for 12 straight years, played with the game designer, Randy Heller, close personal friend of his, and to the point where I sat down with him, and he was, there's a whole setup for this game, there's a large setup chart, because there's a ton of counters, and he's literally picking out of a pile, placing them on the map, without looking at the chart, so... He's like, oh, okay, well, I'll kind of show you how it goes. And that's exactly what happened. He had basically coached me. He explained his moves to me and then coached me five. And we did that for a couple of turns. And his dice rolling was horribly bad to the point where he said, I've never rolled this badly in a game in 12 years. And eventually he stopped giving me advice. And I sort of hung on for a win in that one. That was kind of all good.
Yeah.
But that was definitely me learning how to play a game, even though I had played it. So.
Did you play the Germans or the Americans?
I played the Americans, and he kind of laughed at me when I started to play the Americans, because for those guys, playing the Americans, like the Americans have to do so many things right early on for them. I mean, he's like, okay, well, you can do that, and that's kind of why he coached me through my turn. But, like I said, his die rolling was so bad that, you know, after the first couple of turns, he was way behind where he thought he needed to be. And,
so you must have been doing something right.
I was letting him roll bad dice. That was what I was doing right.
Some days that works.
Yeah, it definitely worked. I mean, he was very nice to me. He was very much like, I'm going to help you learn the game, which was cool. But, you know, it wasn't like I won. It's he lost was what happened.
Some days that works, though.
He rolled badly.
Yeah. Well, some days that works. Some days that's all you need.
Yeah, well, what I learned is that those guys were, like, hardcore serious about the game. I mean, I learned, you know, it's not, you know, you play a game three times, you think you know how to play the games. That's not the same thing as playing it for 12 years straight, so.
Yeah. How did you do in the next round of the tournament?
I dropped out of the second round.
Oh, okay. So you gave somebody else a bye?
Yeah, so what happens, I played in the mulligan round. I technically won that, so I skipped to the second round, which was the next day. The problem is the place we were staying, there were two fire alarms that night, so you didn't really sleep, and then I woke up in the morning and my glasses actually broke, and I spent 2 hours trying to find a screw to screw my glasses back together. And so at that point, I was tired and not in a particularly great mood, and I knew I was going to get my ass handed to me anyway, so I don't think anyone was surprised when I dropped out of that round. And there were plenty of other games to play, so... I just picked up another game.
But you went 1-0, right?
Yes, and technically in my group, I was the only person that won that round. So,
so
I
mean, you're
in the first
undefeated.
Round, I was the only American that won. So I took that and just went with it.
So you quit while you were ahead.
Oh, absolutely.
That's what you're going.
I knew what the outcome was going to be after that. So.
Sounds like a story worth sticking with then.
Yeah, I'm sticking with it for sure.
Hey, Gary, you...
I want to say, because that was the first Compass Expo that they did. It was great. I mean, they put on a great con. They were very happy with it. There were a lot of cool games. And everything they had at the con was 50% off, so I picked up a couple of games for pretty cheap money. So
well,
I had a great time at the con in general, even though, you know, I knew I was going to get my ass kicked in the tournament.
Oh!
I was going to come back around to you for telling us all about Compass Con later, but if you want to go ahead and be the infomercial slash suck up artist here, that's totally cool. Give folks the little bit of lowdown of sort of what Compass Con was supposed to be, and then obviously you played Bitter Woods, but what were some of the other things you played, and what was some of the loot you brought home?
Well, they were very cool about having an open gaming space, so you could just show up and play whatever you wanted. I was definitely into playing the Bitter Woods thing because I wanted to play. I mean, Randy Heller was running, this is the game designer running a tournament. So I was definitely into that, and he was a great guy. I mean, very down-to-earth, very approachable, and all the guys were. It's just they were pretty hardcore about playing it, so I was definitely – I felt like a guppy amongst sharks the whole time. But that it was all very cool, and the Compass folks were great. I mean, you could play whatever you wanted, and there were a ton of awesome Compass games going on. I wound up playing some MMP games later on, because we had, you know, some games that we were familiar with. And after I got we all got our asses basically handed to us in the Bitter Woods tournament. We were looking for something we knew how to play. But it was a fun time. It was a great space. They've planned out, like, I think they have a multi-year deal in the space we're playing, so they're definitely looking at doing more of those. It was hard to adjust the turnout. I mean, I don't know what they were expecting. I know they got more than what they were expecting. I want to say maybe they got like 100% participants. Maybe it was kind of hard for me to judge. They had a fairly good sized space with a lot of games going on. There seemed to be people, everyone seemed to be very happy about the space and about the variety of the games. And like I said, I was happy to be buying stuff at 50% off the normal prices. So
what was some of the loot that you brought home with you?
I brought home South China Sea, which is their modern naval game that's fairly new. It's kind of a redo of Breaking the Chains, which was a similar game they did a couple years back. And then there's a Korea Fire and Ice, which is the, you know, actual 50s Korean War. So I picked that one up. I would have picked up a lot more if I had the budget for it because the prices they had were just so good. Those are that couple that I happened to pick up. Plus, they had a flea market table with a bunch of stuff on it, which, again, if I had had, you know, a bigger budget, I would have brought home a ton of games.
So. Yeah, well, the problem, of course, is that you're going to start saving now to be ready for next year, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely, yeah, no, I'm already thinking about that. So, I didn't even realize it. I don't know if I missed it. I didn't realize they were doing the 50% off their own games because I definitely would have planned better for that. Like, I got the price here. I'm like, damn, these prices are crazy good. So I don't know if they didn't advertise it or if I just missed it or it was like an unplanned thing. But, I mean, I literally could have bought 6 or 8 games if I had had a better budget for it.
Maybe they felt the need to compete with the GMT sale.
Maybe, I don't know. I mean, they're doing their own holiday sale, and they did, you got like a little packet for showing up. You got a t-shirt if you pre-reg and all that. And I have a 25% off coupon they gave me for a future game, like within the next 6 months or whatever, which is nice, and I'll definitely take advantage of. But, you know, when you see pretty much all their published games for 50% off, it's like, okay, I want this one, you know.
Well, sounds like a plan.
Yeah, right. No, it was a great, I think they were very happy, like, I think it was a better turnout than what they were expecting. I thought it was a great thing. It's like 2.5-3 hours from where I live, so, I mean, that's a no-brainer. So
Gary, yeah. Has Chris now talked you into planning a trip to Connecticut for next fall?
So I'm going to try to go to Consum World Expo next year. We'll see if that actually happens. So that's Connecticut's not really, like, vastly closer in terms of logistics than Phoenix is. So, I mean, it's a lot closer, obviously, but I'd still have to fly there. So,
yeah.
If the budget version of that trip will be to WBC, because that is totally drivable for me. That's about 2 hours away.
Yeah, WBC is not too far from Central Ohio there, so. I think I can get to WBC in a little less than a day, about three quarters of a day to get up there, but it's still a bit of a haul for me. I think, Chris, it's most of a day for you to get there. So,
yeah.
Well, sounds like CompassCon was a good time, and certainly some mad props to the Compass guys there for pulling that together and starting that up. So you said they've got a multi-year deal with that location. So right now we're expecting it to be in the same place every year for the foreseeable future and not something that's going to bounce around different locations.
That's my understanding. They kind of brought it up on, I think it was Sunday night, which I think was the last night. I mean, they bought everybody pizza on the last night. They were all pretty excited. They brought up the thing where they were negotiating like a multi-year event at that space. The space itself was fine for gaming. The hotel was a little weird because it was an older place, so it was kind of funky. I'm not knocking it. It's just, you know, you kind of got like the, Overlook Shining vibe too.
Yeah, I was about to say the oddly dressed bartender in the vest.
There were sort of some halls you walk down, you're like, is this hall getting smaller as I'm walking down?
Random twins appearing in the corridor.
Yeah, exactly.
Scatman Crothers is the deck groundskeeper.
Yeah, he falls in front of you with an axe in his back. No, it wasn't that bad. It was just a weird space. But the gaming space was fine. There was just a huge open gaming space with lots of tables and all of that. So, no, they seemed happy with it, and they were talking about, I mean, they're definitely planning it as an ongoing thing. This year was not a bust for them. So, that's all cool. I would definitely go back to game at that space. I'm not sure I would stay there, but I would go back and play more games.
Well, that sounds excellent, and maybe by next year we'll actually have our act together and have some Armchair Dragoons t-shirts for you to wear whilst gaming and, maybe even a couple of them to hand over to the Compass guys to include in some of the prizes and giveaway stuff they got. Hey Gary, you made a comment earlier about, going to order the game and then by the time you got home, it was out of stock. The guys in, the Exploding Unicorns game, I think maybe it wasn't Exploding Unicorns because it was Exploding Kittens was the original game, right? And then, so there was the Unicorns sort of ripoff of that they had at Origins this past year. And it sold out by like Saturday morning. It sold out really quick. And so the dude was taking pre-orders, and offering free shipping, and there was some particular deal on it. I think it was like 10% off and free shipping or something like that. And he was going to ship everything as soon as he got home on Monday. He just didn't have an opportunity to get more inventory to the convention. And he said he brought more than he thought he was going to sell and still sold it out really fast. He wasn't expecting it to catch fire like that. And we were walking, we talked to the dude and our buddy Cyrano's like, all right, I may come back and grab this. And he pulled out his phone and looked it up on Amazon, and the Amazon sale that was going on was going to be like 15% off, and Prime shipping was going to have it for free anyway. And he's like, I could just place the order now. It'll be waiting for me when I get home on Monday instead of waiting for him to get home on Monday and then put it in the mail. So he had it faster ordering off of Amazon Prime than he would have ordering direct from the dude and having it shipped to him. It just worked out that way. He also did the same thing you mentioned, Sovereign of the Seas, earlier. Cyrano did the same thing going home from the convention one year. He found, apparently, this was the one Age of Sail game that's ever been released that he didn't know about ahead of time, inexplicably. And he pulled over at a highway rest stop and actually placed the order from the highway to make sure that he got the order in while it was still on pre-order for the pre-order pricing. So, The placing the order from the convention is not an unheard of sort of thing. It's now become an honorable tradition. Speaking of, Chris, back at CompassCon, did they have some new stuff that's hitting P500 or pre-order that they were showing off, trying to drum up some interest?
They had some stuff that was in testing. There's one game I'm thinking of in particular that a buddy of mine played in basically the whole weekend. It wasn't a published game, is something that's in development for them. So, yeah, they had some of that stuff going on. This was something, I mean, basically there were a bunch of people playing it with the designer, playtesting it. And it was, I mean, they literally played the whole weekend.
Yeah.
And it was it's a massive course and pocket game. So I don't know if it's, I don't know enough to know that it was, I don't know if it's officially like something that they have put out there as it's in development, or like this was something they were running specifically for the feedback. It looked incredible.
Okay.
It was massive. I wasn't directly involved in it. A couple of the guys that I went down with played it pretty much the whole weekend. So.
Well, they must have been enjoying
it. So, yeah, that's what was going on. I mean.
Yeah. Gary, last pre-pub something that you played at a convention somewhere. Has there been one?
Well, yeah, actually, third winner at Buckeye Game Fest.
Okay. Oh, that's so, right. That one's still in. That one is still in playtesting,
yep.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it's not even up for pre-order yet, and I think it's going to be not the next OCS game that goes up for pre-order, but the one after that. But the designer's already working on the sequel, which is going to be the working title anyway. It's called Forgotten Battles, and it's basically Operation Bagration. So you can tack it on to Third Winter in much the same way that you could tack on Case Blue onto Guderian's Blitzkrieg 2. That should get played at Winterfest in February.
I remember it was probably shortly before you started hanging with the cabbies regularly, but back before Jim Reasoner passed, when they first moved into Mossel, but even before that, going back to the old space that they had in the strip mall near Easton, they were testing what's it's Beyond the Rhine. Is that the title? Did I get that right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So
Beyond the Rhine is dedicated to Jim.
Yes. Jim spent 4 years playtesting that thing, so I could totally see that. I remember, you know, going to regular cabs meetings, and I always go back there and chat with them, and they always tried to rope me into the game, and I can appreciate the level of detail and fidelity that OCS has without wanting to dedicate like 9 consecutive Friday nights to playing it. but those guys, I mean, they set the whole thing up, and they played an entire campaign through it, and then they traded sides and did it again, and then they traded sides and did it again, but tried to do some stuff differently just to see what would happen. And part of it is those guys are pretty experienced OCS players.
Oh, yeah.
To the point where they don't even necessarily need all the charts out. Like, they roll the dice and they know what the weather results are.
They have the charts memorized.
Yes, yes.
These are the guys I'm playing OCS with now is the guys that played with Jim.
Yes.
So, yeah, they have the charts memorized.
Yeah, it's kind of like the guys that you know, grew up playing Panzer Blitz and Panzer Leader. Like, they just have the dice on the table and they don't need the CRT.
Oh, yeah, so that's 6-1. In very close, and you rolled a 10, so that's an DL-101.
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's just like that.
But they, I remember them making a whole lot of notes on the whole thing as well. What was also fun was watching the playtest map evolve as they would get changes from the designer. So the original playtest map was essentially a whole lot of hexes with a lot of highlighter on it. I think the hexes were colored in with green and yellow and pink and brown highlighters. And then as changes would come in, they would get actual printed stuff to replace. So you'd have this patchwork of map tiles out there where some of them were actual printed with terrain that looked pretty close to final art that was sort of taped over top of the previously highlighted hex grid map, and by the time, you know, a couple of years had gone by, it was mostly replaced with something that looked close to a production copy. I just remember sort of the evolution of the map.
The Third Winter components are real close to final at this point, the map and the counters.
Yeah. A I'll edit out the dead air. I was caught taking a drink.
That's all right.
The beauty of the edit button.
Just edit out the worrying when I was having to think about what the last pre-publication game I played was. Because I'm not a big playtester. It's the first game I've playtested in quite a while, actually. And I'm not doing the OCS game at Winterfest, so.
Yeah. Well, were you jumping into it with the intent of, like, trying to provide some playtest feedback, or you just wanted to get a feel to see how it compared to the other OCS games, or was that just what happened to fit into the schedule that you were interested in?
It's what happened to fit into the schedule that I was interested in more than anything else, but I had been playing OCS regularly with one of the local OCS groups. It's very fertile territory over here for OCS.
Yeah, I love that you've got one of the local OCS groups.
Yeah.
Yeah, like this.
So I wanted to have the experience of playing a big game like that more or less constantly, you know, for a whole week and being able to focus on it and stay focused on it. One of the problems that we have is two of the guys that we play with now are retired, right?
Yes.
Retired gentlemen of leisure, as I keep telling them. So they have, I'm gonna take the motor home and the wife, and we'll be back in a couple of months. So we take 2 months off, and then we come back. We're coming back to actually Beyond the Rhine after that exact scenario this week. And, you know, I have no idea where we were. You know, I mean, I know roughly where we were. We're in late September 1944. I know I have no supply. I remember that. But, I mean, I don't know exactly what my plans were.
So it's not totally unrealistic to the battlefield of sort of, you know, you wake up the next morning and aren't really sure what the plans were.
Right.
So
the good news is that since we last played OCS, Beyond the Rhine, I've played an entire week of Third Winter at Buckeye Game Fest. We played a complete game of OCS Smolensk, and we started a game of Guderian Blitzkrieg 2 about a month ago. So I'm going to come back to that game substantially more experienced with OCS than I was when we left off.
Well, oh, yeah. You got that going for you then. Gary, I guess the answer to this one for you is going to be coming back to Beyond the Rhine probably, but the next big thing you're planning to get to the table, Beyond the Rhine, I guess the return too, but is there something else that's in imminent danger of making it to the table here that's a larger something, not like a one afternoon, one session kind of game?
As a matter of fact, there is.
Uh-huh.
So on Tuesday, we resume Beyond the Rhine. On Wednesday, we are going to set up Last Chance for Victory.
All right.
Which is the Gamer's Line of Battle giant three-map Gettysburg game, four-map Gettysburg game.
So you're borrowing somebody's garage for this?
No, that's in a basement. We have one guy's got an extra bedroom, and we have two 4x8 tables set up in there, one of which is Beyond the Rhine, and the other one is a Labatt game that I'm not playing in. And I think it's Wagram, as I recall. And then the other guy, he's got two folding tables in a basement. It's big enough to fit that.
Well, there you go. Chris, I know you've got a game group that gets together regularly on some weekends here and there. What's the next big something you guys are going to be trying to tackle or that you think you're jumping into?
We have a big game coming up. I think it's Austerlitz for minis. That's going to be Fire, not Fire and Fury, but that system. It's Age of Eagles.
Okay.
Fire and Fury system. So that's coming out next month. There has been talk about this, me and another guy, that for, BCS, we both have the last Blitzkrieg. We're talking about trying to get that onto a table. I also have GMT's Mets game. And
yeah, but that's not really a monster. I mean, you can probably get a solid playing of one of the normal size scenarios for that one in an afternoon, can't you?
Yeah, that's doable. I mean, that's a thing we could do. Like, yeah, we could do that. There's some scenarios we could do in an afternoon.
Yeah.
There's some appeal. We've been doing some Franco-Prussian War stuff in minis. That's kind of why there's some appeal about doing it as a board game.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the thought behind that. So any of those are options for, like, coming up stuff.
Do you go Franco or do you go...
I play the Pacific War from Lock and Load to do a review.
You know, it wouldn't hurt.
Yeah, no, that's on the to-do list. Trust me, these are all games that are actually sitting on my table right now.
How many of them are still in shrink?
none of the ones I've talked about are still in shrink.
If the Pacific War was, then you re-shrunk it.
No, that's out. I mean, no, I've got some that are in shrink, but everything I just told you about is not in shrink.
So that is the Pacific War, as I recall, not Pacific War. This is not the old Mark Herman Victory Games Pacific War. This is a one-map game, actually, interestingly, by a Japanese designer.
Yes.
And in fact, I won it from you, Brent, at Origins.
Well, not me personally, but yeah.
So I have looked it over.
That was the same year that I bought it at Origins, Gary.
Oh, okay. It looks interesting.
It does look interesting, and I do want to play it. And it's a fairly straightforward game that seems very doable in an afternoon or evening. And I would love to actually – I've been trying to get it on the table for a couple of months now, and it has not worked out.
Yeah, I've got my copy of it here. My problem is I can't find anybody interested enough in that theater to actually sit down and play.
Oh, I love the theater.
Wow, you got to come back up here.
Yeah, so, Gary, my issue here is the local wargaming community here is actually reasonably well-populated. What it's not is well-organized. It's a lot of twos and threes that get together to play pretty regularly,
sure.
but not a lot of cross-pollination between those groups. The group around here that is pretty well organized are the Minis guys. The Triangle Simulation Society around here holds a lot of regular Minis game days and actually runs two small weekend Minis focused conventions here in town. Southern Front and I want to say Fall In, but I think that's an HMGS one. They run two of them around here. Southern Front is one, and I can't remember the other one. And the hotel they use for that is almost walking distance to my house. It's bike riding distance to my house. But it's Minis guys, and I'm just not a big Minis gamer. I don't mind sitting down and playing a Minis game every once in a while, but certainly not to the level of insanity that these guys do. Otherwise, you know, the group of war gamers in the area that we've got, there's plenty of them around here. Bruce Garrick and Dick Vollers and all those guys are all around here, and a lot of them are playtesters for MMP and the gamers and GMT and Clash of Arms and whoever else. But they've got their regular little game groups, and they just sort of stick with them, and they don't coalesce around a bigger group at all like you've got up there with Cabs. Which is, it's unfortunate, given how many players we've got in the area. It just is what it is. So it's tough to find opponents sometimes that you can work into some scheduling. Unfortunately, I have a feeling that my circumstance is far more common across the country than your circumstance is.
Oh, I think that's probably true.
Yeah. I mean, you're in a fairly large city, but still, to have multiple OCS groups in town is definitely that's a wargaming luxury right there.
That's hilarious. Oh, well, it's, you know, with one of these several OCS groups that I have available.
Yeah. Yeah. There's probably a half a dozen people that just threw foam bricks at the podcast when they heard that.
Columbus, Ohio, ladies and gentlemen, your epicenter for OCS.
Yeah.
The gaming paradise.
Well,
I don't know about all that, but if you want to play OCS, yeah, we got you covered up here.
Yeah.
Awesome.
But realistically, a lot of those guys are, you know, cabbies or were brought into it through somebody from Cabs. And
yeah.
When you've got the infrastructure of a large club like that, it really helps for people being able to just find an option for tabletop gaming and meet other folks who are going to game. And Cabs, I mean, they regularly get, what, 100, 150 at a meeting on a Friday night?
Oh, easily.
Yeah, and so...
100 to 200 people.
Yeah, now, maybe 5 to 10% of that are actual Wargamers, but 5 to 10% of 200 people is still a good number of Wargamers in the room together, and way more than you're going to get in most Wargaming clubs around the country that meet on a regular basis. So that's not a bad place to go, even if you're not playing the stuff at Cabs, to find and meet the people to get together and play elsewhere. Is
yeah, so there's no regularly scheduled wargaming at those meetings anymore. But if you don't know anybody and you're on the Facebook group, you can say, "Hey, I would like to play some wargames. Anybody coming up this Saturday?" And you do that two or three times, and you'll get some people that will jump on that, and people will show up and play wargames from relatively light stuff like and even the relatively light stuff gets played all the time. Your Twilight Struggles and your Combat Commanders and your Commands and Colors, that type of stuff does get played almost every week.
Yeah.
But if you want to play something big that needs to get set up, then they don't have any or needs to stay set up. They don't have a space dedicated to that anymore. So you're basically gotta find a place.
Yeah. Yeah.
To keep it set up for God knows how long in our case.
Yeah. Yeah. Or working around the RV trips to visit the kids in Colorado, you know. the other thing, though, I mean, because you've got those Saturday meetings, you could play an 8-hour game, you know, a more extended one if you wanted to, because you have that available to you.
Yeah, so. We had the, I was playing, we had organized a game of Normandy 44, which is a fabulous game. And we got started at like 11 a.m. and about 7 p.m. I forget what the name is, that the plague game.
Pandemic?
That's very popular. Yeah. So they had like a pandemic tournament that day. And the pandemic guys come up to us at like, I don't know, 7 p.m. and they're like, yeah, I don't know. We're going to start our tournament in like an hour. Are you guys going to be done by then? I like look at my watch. Yeah. Well, we've been playing for about 8 hours so far. I'm not sure we're going to be done by then. They looked at me like I had just sprouted a second head. They had no idea. They were like, I could see the gears turning. It's like, wait a minute. Have these guys seriously been playing the same game for 8 hours? Is that what he's saying? That's what was going through his head.
Yeah.
So it was a fairly hilarious moment. So, but yeah, we have absolutely gone up there and played a game for 12 hours before.
So you mentioned folks that were going to wargame with Twilight Struggle. Is Twilight Struggle a wargame? Come on.
It's an honorary wargame. Somebody called it an honorary wargame, and that's good enough for me. So there's actually a guy on YouTube. I am willing to have these discussions with people. However, I think it's generally an unprofitable discussion unless it's, you know, we're just having fun batting ideas back and forth about what's a wargame, what's not a wargame.
Yeah.
Marco Arnaudo, who is Marco Wargamer on YouTube, who does a lot of board game reviews, but he's into wargames too and does a fair number of wargame reviews.
Yeah.
His definition of wargame I really liked. He said, it's a wargame if when I'm playing it, I feel like I'm playing a wargame. And I'm like, yeah, okay, that works for me. So in that sense, I mean, is Twilight Struggle my idea of wargame when I think I want to go wargame this weekend? No, not at all. But, you know, it's close enough. I don't think it's particularly profitable to quibble about it and hurt people's feelings.
No, I was just being a smartass about the fact that, you know, there's every 6 months or so, somebody throws that topic out there on Board Game Geek and everybody groans and goes, oh my God, here we go again. And then there's at least a half a dozen guys who can't help themselves and immediately jump on that.
Yeah.
You know, oh my God, exactly. There's no way in hell.
Oh, and people get totally worked up about that. That's the thing. If everybody was just laughing about it, that would be one thing. But people get worked up over that question.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't see any profit or value or use in people getting in actual arguments over the question of this game's a war game and this game's not. It's a historical game. It's, like I said, it's close enough for me. If we want to call it an honorary war game or war game adjacent, as I've also heard it called, then I think that's perfectly fine.
The once upon a time, I was a full fledged member of the Indignant Brigade about those things. But I, since then, I've limited myself to the pedantic arguments. You know, I've tried to limit it only to places where relevant, such as if you're looking into some kind of academic study of something, or if you are looking into to some place where the splitting of hairs is actually necessary for defining what is an out is in scope versus out of scope for a particular reason, then yes, I'll start splitting hairs on certain things. Otherwise, I'm going to shrug and go, all right, call it whatever the hell you want. In academia, such, you know, minute distinctions in definition actually do matter. And so that's sort of where I had come at that from. But I've realized for the hobbyist, dude, as long as you're playing a game and having a good time, who gives a rip what you call it?
Exactly.
So that is something I think I've mellowed a bit over the last couple of years. I will still, sort of poke the badger every once in a while and mess with James Sterrett. And tell him that's a simulation, that's not a game, or that's a game, not a simulation. Just to mess with him a little bit, because we've had, you know, this 15-year running discussion going on the differences between a game and a simulation. And, not because either one of us is really ever going to change each other's minds. We both have our own viewpoints that we come to out of the utility of where we were working and doing things. But because it makes a very interesting starting point for a discussion when we have other people in the room. And we ran, a regular lecture, as a part of the War College series back when we did more stuff with the Origins War College about the uses of games and sims in military training. And it was a 2-hour panel discussion that we'd rope in whatever other game designers happened to be at Origins that year. So 1 year we had Miranda with us on the panel. 1 year we had, John Tiller was there. 1 year we dragged him into the panel with us. Matt Caffrey was always there, so he was always a part of it. But we've had a variety of both hobby and professional designers there, and a bunch of folks that straddle both sides of that fence, like Tiller, because some of his games are actually used by the Air Force in their professional development. And that was one of the first things that we would always throw out, because it was always a great conversation starter of, okay, so what's the difference between a game and a simulation? And then sort of get the audience engaged in the discussion that way. And so nobody was ever going to answer the question to someone's satisfaction and have the light bulb go off in their head. Aha, you are correct. You have committed. Like, that's never going to happen. But it was always a great place to start the conversations. So it worked. So, Chris, Twilight Struggle, is it a war game?
Nope. I know that's going to piss a lot of people off.
It's going to piss off Katie.
I played Twilight Struggle. I know that people think it's the greatest thing ever. It was not my cup of tea. I do not for 1 second consider it a war game. So there you go. That's my opinion.
Yeah, there's plenty of war games I've played that aren't my cup of tea that I still think are war games.
Sure, and I agree with that. But I don't think Twilight Struggle is a board game.
Yeah.
Twilight Struggle is, I'm a board game.
Okay.
A historically themed board game, I guess. I don't know. It's not a war game. Whatever. You asked me, I told you. There you go.
I know.
People can direct the, hate mail at Brant Guillory.
I know how to use a forward button. That's easy enough.
Yeah, okay. No, I'm not knocking it.
We will have to resolve the question with fisticuffs.
Yeah, okay. How about just with alcohol?
Well, that's fine, too.
Okay. No, I know people love that game, and I have played it. I have played it with some actual people in my group who absolutely love it. You know, it's not even that I didn't care for it. I just don't think of it as a war. I think if I loved the game, I wouldn't categorize it as a war game.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Now, I'm a big fan, especially digital, but I'm a big fan of 4X games and a lot of the Civ Builder, City Builder type games, just because I really enjoy them. And I think I know some folks that sort of lump a game like Civilization in with war games in that they are large, complex, time-consuming sorts of games. But I really don't know a whole lot of folks that would consider one of the Civ games, especially on the tabletop, to be, you know, whether we're talking Civ or Historia or you know, Mare Nostrum or any of those similar ones, I don't know a whole lot of people that would consider any of them to be war games, despite the fact that there is a significant combat element to all of them. Because there's plenty of other things to do besides just sort of beat people over the head with sticks. And I enjoy those kinds of games just as much as I enjoy traditional hex encounter, you know, tanks blowing stuff up kind of war games.
Sure.
But I've always found, you know, because those tend to have a little broader appeal than the, you know, as Cyrano calls it, the high nerdery of the wargaming hobby. That I can still get sort of my strategic gaming fix out of those 4X games. And I do enjoy the exploration component of those 4X games. So that's always a nice touch for me.
This is kind of a religious conversation. And I mean that in the sense of, you know, philosophical, you know, we're into points where it's all your perspective because I don't think of Axis and Allies as a war game, which it absolutely is a war game, but I don't think of it the same way as, I don't know, I just don't.
Yeah.
I don't think of Risk as a war game. I don't know. I mean, you're really getting into, you know.
Yeah. And again, though, you know, to what purpose would that discussion even, you know, what are we hoping to accomplish by having that discussion ever? And again,
oh, nothing. It's just the conversations that, you know, nerds have.
But, you know, I've had them where relevant and meaningful in some particular academic exercises where there was a need to draw lines between particular categories, you know, when distinguishing between certain things, when you're trying to collect data sets, and particularly if you're doing statistically relevant data sets, you have to draw lines between categories to know where to put the numbers. And so, sure, in a case like that, it is absolutely relevant that you draw those distinctions. Those distinctions will be argued over ad nauseum as to whether or not you drew the lines in the right places. The key is to clearly articulate where you drew the lines. And then people, they can disagree with the definition, but at least they understand where you're putting things based on the definition you gave. And so, you know, again, from an academic perspective, sometimes that's necessary. I think the rest of the time, you know, younger us's would have argued over this as though it actually was meaningful in some way. Whereas slightly more mature us's are like, whatever, dude, just play a game you like. And I think that's, you know, that's a place that I think we've all kind of come to over the years of it's hard enough to find a group of folks that want to play the same kind of stuff that you like and aren't going to, you know, have to take an entire game session just learning the rules, that you don't want to waste time arguing over dumb stuff.
I don't know, there's plenty of other things to argue over.
Yeah, yeah. What are your favorite dice, D6s or D10s? I was just finding something else to argue over.
Yeah. Well, D6 games aren't real games anyway, so... There you go. You want to argue about that?
Yeah.
I hate D6s.
Gary, I think we've asked you this once before, but what's the oldest set of dice that you've got?
I've got some D&D dice from the original Moldvay basic set. Those would be my oldest dice, I'm pretty sure.
So that's the Moldvay basic set, you're looking at 83?
Yeah, remember those putty-type dice that they used to have where they wear down real fast? No, this is the older one.
So that's the Errol Otis set.
That's the Metzner set.
Oh, okay.
The Moldvay one dates from about 79 or 80, I believe. 3 or 4 years or older.
Yeah, I know the one with the Errol Otis cover. I think you're looking at 80, it might be 80 or 81.
It might be 80, 81.
Cause I think the old Blue Book set was 78, and I think the colored cover of that same game was 79. So I'm thinking the Moldvay one with the Otis cover was 80 or 81, because I think it was when I was living in California the second time. Been back to California a couple times. So I'm not sure.
I have some Avalon Hill dice that are actually older, but those are the oldest dice that I've had with me. You know, they have been my dice in my dice box the whole time.
Yeah, I'm not sure I still have any of mine from that box. I have a bunch from around the same era that have kind of gotten commingled in with some others, but I couldn't definitively say that, yes, I could tell you that that die is from that time period. I do have a handful of D8s that I specifically remember buying in 83 when we lived in Germany. They are D8s with pips instead of numbers engraved in them.
I've seen dice like that.
Yeah, I've got three or four of them, and I picked them up at a local German toy store, and mainly for the novelty of them. Lord knows I didn't need any more dice at the time, but the novelty of D8s with pips on them I just thought was kind of cool, and so I grabbed a handful of them. So I think most wargamers of approximately our age probably have dice that could have easily retired from the army by now. And in some cases may have been forced out of the army at, you know, their age at this point. So, from their amount of time. Chris, what's the oldest set of dice you got?
Oh, I mean, I don't know. I think going back, I probably have a couple of dice kicking around from an original Axis and Allies game that I bought about 30 years ago. So,
yeah.
And, you know. So those classic red D6, I think I have a couple of those. I've had dice come and go so much over the years.
Yeah.
Mostly because I get mad and I kind of huck them as far as I can throw them. So.
Gary, did you ever pick up one of the giant mugs of dice at one of the booths at the conventions?
No, I tend to pick and choose my dice. I mean, since Chessex isn't at Origins anymore, I haven't bought nearly as many dice, but I'm usually good for buying a few. But I've never done the big random assortment. I've always picked and chosen the dice that I wanted.
Yeah, well, you could hand pick a mug of dice at the Chessex booth. It just costs more to hand pick them than it did to just scoop them. The way around that was to sort of sit there and kind of hand pick a little bit and cluster a whole bunch of the ones you wanted over in kind of one corner of the tub, so that when you got the mug, you'd go over to that corner and scoop, and you'd get the you know, dozen or so that you threw into that corner along with whatever else you happened to get.
If there's one thing I don't need, it's a half a pound of random dice. There might be specific dice I'm looking for, like brown dice or D10s with 10s instead of zeros on them, or something D8s with Roman numerals instead of regular numbers. But I don't need any random dice. I have a cabinet full of dice in here, man. I do not need more, just random dice.
Yeah.
There might be specific things that I want, but I don't need random dice.
I did take the plunge one time and bought the mug of random dice just to do it. It wasn't like a true bucket list sort of thing, but I was like, you know, I've been walking past this booth for like 8 years now at this convention. I'm buying a mug of dice. And so I sort of scooped a bunch of the ones I kind of liked over to one corner. I told my son, I was like, hey, are there any in here you really want? And he sort of pushed a few into that corner, and we went and grabbed a mug and scooped it up. And we got all the ones we pushed into the corner, so that was a good thing. But yeah, I've still got the mug sitting here behind me, where we're recording. I'm not even sure what's in the mug. It's not those dice anymore, obviously. Okay, so I have a shrink-wrapped bag of a full RPG set that I have no idea what box this came out of. Probably one of the recent D&D starter boxes. And I have, what all is in here? Oh, I've got a bunch of my really tiny D20s from Twerps. If y'all have ever seen.
I remember those.
Yeah, so the world's easiest role-playing system, which was actually a delightfully fun, campy little role-playing system. It was really quite a joy to play.
It was cute.
It was. These are D20s that are maybe a half an inch, and impossible to read. Even if you ink them up with the you know, some ink or a crayon, they're still impossible to read. And then I've got a whole bunch of sort of speckled dice of random colors and numbers in here, and I've got a bunch of D6s that have dragons on them for the six. Not sure what else is in this mug. Yeah, that's what's in here. Oh, there's a couple of stray Lego pieces in here. I'm not really sure how those got in here.
I tend to not do the speckled or multicolored dice. I like my dice in monochrome.
Yeah, my Origins 2011 commemorative die is in here.
For specific games, right? There is very few people that are more OCD about dice than I am. First of all, I want a thematically appropriate dice. So if I'm playing a game like a Bulge game, then I want the Germans to be rolling black or gray dice, and the Americans to be rolling green dice. And if there's British, they can roll red dice, or better yet, tan dice. I have a complete set, the GMT Napoleonic Wars, okay? There's, I think it's a six or maybe even up to eight player game. I have a tray in the box of dice of 24 of each of the national colors for the game. So the French got blue dice, the Russians got green dice, the Austrians got white dice, the British got red dice. The Prussians have black dice.
I was going to say, tell me the Prussians had purple. That would have been too much fun.
The Danes have orange dice because they're orange in the game. The Spanish have yellow dice. So yeah, it's obsessive.
Yeah. Did you go out and get the special nationality dice to go with the Axis and Allies boxes that replaced the sixes with the flags or the roundrels?
I don't know. I've never played Axis and Allies.
Okay,
that's not true, actually. But it's not a game that's within my sphere of interest these days.
Gotcha.
I played it back in the day. I haven't played it. I guess they've made some changes to it. I haven't played it since its original edition.
Yeah. One of the dice I just pulled out of this mug is my Origins 11 commemorative die. So I imagine it was Origins 2011 when I got this mug.
I've got the Origins and Gen Con die, where Origins and Gen Con were both in Milwaukee.
Yeah.
And they like combined the two conventions, which I think they did twice, but I only went to the one.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm guessing that's the year that this mug came out was that year. Cause that's the die that I've got in there. I'm still not sure why the random Lego pieces are in there either. That's kind of amusing. Most of the dice, my son wanted a bunch of the two-tone dice, where it's sort of, white and blue kind of blending together with red numbers on them. So we've got a bunch of those two-tone dice that we got in that mug. But, I can totally see the OCD-ness of the dice. Back when I was picking up a whole bunch of HeroScape stuff, because it was fun to play with my son back when he was like 3 and 4 and 5 years old. For Christmas one year, some of my family got a whole bunch of the standard bearers for each of the different factions that came in that were present in HeroScape. And so I've got a whole bunch of the flag bearers, but each one of those came with about a dozen custom dice that were color-coded to the different factions. And so I've got, I think, 4 of the 5 factions in the giant HeroScape tub here in the game den. I'd have to dig them out and see. You mentioned being obsessive about matching dice to games. Let's face it, gamers are kind of weird about our dice. In terms of what we like and what we store and what we use and what we don't use. So it can be a little weird. I have a D20 that came in one of the Monte Cook expansion kits for the old Iron Heroes, and it's a full chunk die cast metal one. I think it's stainless steel. I'm not really sure. It's a weapon. If you throw it at somebody, you're causing damage. We used to use that one in some of our role playing games as sort of the streak buster D20. That if you were on a bad streak of die rolls, you could get out that D20 and it would break the streak for you. You couldn't go to the well too many times or it would get a little pissed off and not help you out. But it would, it wasn't rolling 20s all the time. Like if you needed a 12, it would roll a 14 for you. So it would break a streak of bad rolls for you, but you couldn't overtax it or it would turn on you by the end of the night.
And everybody's got their little dice karma, routines and superstitions.
Yes. Let me ask, dice tower or no dice tower?
I like using a dice tower, actually. I liked it enough that I made my own, which the current one is actually cardboard, but I have a wooden one that's in the works. It's been in the works for like a year. I just got to actually bust out the belt sander and finish it.
Chris,
but
dice tower?
I like to use a dice tower.
Chris, dice tower, no dice tower?
No dice tower, I hate them.
Do you get mad if other people at the table are using the dice tower?
No, that does not bother me at all. I do not. Dice towers do not work for me. I like to roll into some kind of box or container that's not a dice tower. I don't like the little clinking part. It jinxes the dice. So.
You should have seen the dice towers that Broken Token has, where they're modular. They're about 8-inch sections that you can stack as many of them as you want. And have it roll. There's a Plinko one. There's one that's just stairs. There's a variety of different ones that you can get and put together. And you could make one of these things two stories high if you really wanted to. So.
No, I don't like that. I like to roll into a straight roll, you know, that sort of Vegas roll.
Use the lid from the game, from the box of the game that you're playing.
Yeah.
That's good
I'm
karma.
I'm curious in that regard. I am very particular about my dice, though, so everything you were saying. I always bring my own dice so that when whatever game I'm playing, those dice turn on me, which they inevitably do. I have a variety of dice I can choose from.
I've long maintained that if you really wanted to make some cheating dice, the easiest one to do that with is the D20 because it's got the most number of faces. But you don't replace ones and twenties. What you do is you replace like the 3 and the 5 and the 6 and tuck in an extra 17 on the, you know, on the high end for yourself. And that's the way you sort of build some loaded D20s for you there.
I do not believe in cheating dice, but I do believe that there are certain dice on a given day that light me better than other dice.
Kind of like people.
Well, nobody ever likes me, so no.
I believe that all dice hate me.
Yeah.
Just easier to start from that assumption, huh?
My experience has been sort of the same. But I like to switch it up, so I like to keep the dice off guard. I don't want any set of dice to develop a hardcore hatred.
So when we played Case Blue, right? As you can imagine, this took a while. We played 2 or 3 days a week for about a year, all right?
Yeah.
So it's OCS, right? So you get 3 turns a week, all right? And we played through about 2 years of the campaign before we hung it up. And the way the reinforcements work in that game is there's a table, right? And you get certain kinds of reinforcements depending on what you roll. So if you roll a 7, you're probably getting a personnel replacement. If you roll a 9, you're probably getting a PAX and an equipment. There's like an emergency reserve pool that you have as the Soviets. The Germans might have it too, but we were playing the Soviets. On a roll of, I think 10 to 12 on 2d6, you can withdraw a unit from the emergency reserve and put it on the map. We played 2 years of this friggin' game, so we probably played about 100 turns of it. We never once pulled a unit out of the emergency reserve.
Oh,
never once. The entire game did we get an emergency reserve replacement.
They were waiting for a real emergency.
I guess so. Oh, that's not an emergency.
Yeah.
Germans at the gates of Moscow? Germans are taking the Grozny oil fields? No, we're good back here, behind the Urals, where it's nice and safe and warm.
Yeah. I want to make an interesting note. Chris, you noticed he said, 2 years of playing twice a week, probably, 100-odd turns of this before we quit. Not before the game ended. Not before somebody won, but before we just said, fuck it, and gave up.
We did not play to the conclusion of the scenario. We had decided that there had been too many costly attacks made by the Soviets in the northern sector, and that they had been too costly, and we didn't have the forces available to extricate ourselves from that situation at the time. I actually feel like I, who was handling the Soviets in the south, would be a lot better equipped now to deal with that type of situation, because I've had now a lot of experience with the OCS supply system and what you need to do to keep your units in supply. And I'm not talking about the SPs, the points necessarily, but to keep your units in trace supply, even though they look obviously overextended on the map, which, you know, it's case blue. There's tons of open space. You have to be completely fluent with the OCS supply rules, all of them, to really make that game work. And I wasn't at the time, and so I didn't position myself well enough to then cut the German spearhead off in the south.
Yeah.
But it was about a year. It was about a year playing 2 or 3 days a week.
I'm just wondering what percentage of OCS games get played to the actual completion of a scenario and which, you know, what percentage of them get played to the completion of the player's patience.
Well, it wasn't that we ran out of patience. It was that we felt like the game had been decided at that point.
Yeah.
We did play Smolensk to its conclusion. We didn't take the last turn. I think we skipped the last turn because the situation was such that the Soviet player, we had to achieve a specific objective as the Germans on the last turn or we would lose. And the Soviet player rolled initiative and won initiative, so he was going to go first. And he would have stopped us from being able to take that objective. So I consider that we played through the whole thing. Now that's a small OCS game, right? That's a one map game. It's relatively counter dense, as anybody who saw the pictures from Buckeye Game Fest can attest. But it's a pretty small game. It took us about a month to play it twice a week.
Yeah,
something like that.
That's not bad at all.
Yeah, and we're not playing for 10 hours a day. We're playing for 3 or 4 hours on weeknights. And we're all old guys. We got to get home in time for Matlock and Murder, She Wrote.
Well, on that note, I think Matlock started 15 minutes ago as we're recording
Uh-oh.
This. So it may be time to pull the plug here. We're a little over an hour, so we're a DC commute if you got stuck in some traffic, in terms of the, not all the traffic, mind you, but some traffic. As folks are listening to this. So, again, tonight was a podcast with no specific agenda, but we had some fun chatting about some of the games that we had poked around with over the last few years, as well as stumbling into some quasi-religious arguments there on what is a war game and don't touch my dice. So, the very next game to hit your table, Gary.
I guess the very next new game that will just be starting will be Last Chance for Victory.
Okay. Chris, very next game to hit the table?
Let's say GMT's Mets game.
At any cost?
Yes.
All right. Sounds good. I think the next thing, well, I just pulled the Pacific War off the table not too long ago. I had it set up. I was ready to play and then couldn't find anybody to play. I think I've got Defenders of the Rhine, the tank-on-tank expansion that's going to be hitting the table here real shortly.
Nice.
Yeah. Well, tank-on-tank stuff is great because it's nice and compact, and it's easy to play like 2 or 3 scenarios in an afternoon. It is one of the best beer and pretzels war games. It's also one of the best introductory war games. It's a ton of fun, and I love it to death. I think Defenders of the Rhine, that expansion may be the next thing to hit my table here. So, Gary, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
Happy to be here.
And, Chris, thank you for joining us where we could hear you.
Yeah, well, my pleasure.
And, folks, stop by Armchair Dragoons. Again, you may, depending on when you're actually listening to this, you may still have a couple of days to register your vote as to what we call this podcast and have your say. And I'm hoping by the time we're recording the next 1 or 2 of these, we'll have some clarity as to what we're going to call this as we start to make our way through season 1 of our new podcast. Thanks, folks. Stop by armchairdragoons.com. Check out our event calendar. Stick your head in the forums and enjoy some conversation. We've got some online Kriegspiel action going on in the forums now there. And then take a look at what we're talking about over on the front page. Some of the videos, some of the articles, some of the conversation. Thanks, everybody, and good night.